Welcome to STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
Welcome to STEM Talk, where we introduce you to fascinating people who passionately inhabit the scientific and technical frontiers of our society. Hi, I'm your host, Dawn Kernaghis, and joining me to introduce today's podcast is a man behind the curtain, Dr. Ken Ford, IHMC's director and chairman of the Double Secret Selection Committee that selects all the guests who appear on STEM Talk.
Hi, Dawn. Great to be here today. Our guest is Dr. Butler Hine, who is a flight project manager and chief technologist for engineering at the NASA Ames Research Center in Mountain View, California. Butler is also a senior research scientist and a colleague of ours here at IHMC. Currently, Butler is the project manager for NASA Arcus mission, which is an X-ray observatory that could possibly launch in 2023.
Before we get to today's interview with Butler, we have some housekeeping to take care of. First, we really appreciate all of you who have subscribed to STEM Talk, and we are especially appreciative of all the wonderful five-star reviews that have been piling up. As we announced in several earlier episodes, the Double Secret Selection Committee has been continually and carefully reviewing iTunes, Google, Stitcher, and other podcast apps for the wittiest and most lavishly praise-filled reviews to read on STEM Talk. As always, if you hear your review read on STEM Talk, just contact us at stemtalk@ihmc.us to claim your official STEM Talk T-shirt.
Today, our winning review was posted by someone who goes by the moniker MaxAttack63. I like that one. And it's titled, Reinvigorating My Love of Science. The review reads, I graduated from school with a BS in exercise science a couple of years ago, and I had a falling out with science. This podcast has allowed me to fall back into my love for science and research. I want to thank the STEM Talk podcast for giving me the inspiration to apply to graduate school. I love the show.
That is awesome and so wonderful, MaxAttack63. Thank you for the review, and thank you to all of our other STEM Talk listeners who've helped STEM Talk become such a great success.
Okay, and now on to our interview with Dr. Butler Hine.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
Hi, welcome to STEM Talk. Today we're excited to welcome Butler Hine to the podcast. Butler, welcome to STEM Talk.
Hi, thanks, Dawn. I'm glad to be here.
And also joining us is Ken Ford.
Indeed. Welcome, Butler.
Thanks, Ken.
Butler, your father was a career Army guy, and you moved around a lot as a consequence as a kid. Is it true that you never went to the same school for more than a couple years in a row until you reached high school?
Yes, that's right. We were moving around when I was growing up. So typically, I'd be in the same school for a year. Once I got to junior high, I had the luxury of being there for 2 years.
Wow.
Now, I had the classic Army brat growing up. And in fact, the thing that kids worry about growing up is that families are going to move away and forget them. That actually happened to me. I came home from school one day and found my room packed up, the house packed up. I didn't know we were moving. The family knew, but they had forgotten to tell the kids, so we didn't know.
Yeah, it's reminiscent of my own childhood. My father was in the Navy, and we moved every 2 or 3 years.
Hmm. So, Butler, I understand that you've described yourself as a classic nerd growing up, which I can associate with, by the way. And I also understand that you were heavily influenced by the Apollo moon landings. Did that impact your overall goals in life?
Yes, I was a classic nerd. I can't even say past tense. I'm still a classic nerd. Growing up, I knew all the Star Trek episodes by heart. The moon landings were a huge impact on me. I was 10 when the Apollo 11 landing happened and was just fascinated by it. Ever since then, I had made it my goal to not only do science, but also become an astronaut. That was my goal starting at 10 years old, was to become an astronaut.
In terms of science, you became interested in astronomy in junior high school. Is it true that you used to build telescopes even back then?
Yes, I was an instrument builder from a very early age, starting at 8 years old. My first telescope was a screen door that I lifted up into a tree because I had heard that you could listen to Jupiter in the 20 megahertz band. So I put this screen door up in the tree and tried to listen to Jupiter. I found out I couldn't listen to Jupiter, but I could listen to thunderstorms. And that telescope was successful up until the day my father caught me in a thunderstorm with a piece of metal up in a tree with a wire coming into the house.
Yeah.
That ended that telescope. My second one was an optical telescope, and that also had a bad ending because I decided I needed to have a spectral comparison. So I dug the carbon rods out of two D-cell batteries, and I wired them with an AC cord and plugged them into our house. Of course, that immediately shorted out the house. And then I figured out, well, I need to put some load in between. So I put a toaster in between. That was my load. And that worked, but until I pulled the carbon rods apart to create the arc while I was staring at it and almost lost my eyesight.
Yeah, hence glasses.
Yeah. The third telescope, which was my penultimate, in high school, I wanted to build an interferometer, radio interferometer, and I wanted to see fringes from the galactic center. So I built these enormous helical antennas that were up on posts in a yard. And this was a place that we had no house on it, but it was up fairly close to a lake. And unfortunately, it was right in the view of my neighbor. And it was right in between his view of the lake and his house. So I did get fringes, but the next weekend when I came back, the telescope had not only been pushed over, but it looked like a truck had driven over it a few times. And that was the end of that telescope.
So during graduate school, you became interested in both science and science implementation. Can you explain the difference to us?
Well, science is the pure science. You're trying to answer a question or do an investigation. Science implementation, to me, is what it takes to enable the science, the observations, or whatever it is you try to do. And I was always drawn to the implementation side. This will probably offend some astronomers, but there's a hierarchy in astronomy. The theorists are at the top. They're the highest cadre. And then you have observationalists who take observations. And then you have the instrument designers, instrument builders. Those are the lowest of the ladder. I actually had a professor tell me early in grad school, he said, you know, if you apply yourself, you'd make a good theorist, but I hate to see you waste your life in building instruments. That was his his advice.
Hmm. You ended up at NASA Ames Research Center for your postdoc, working on planet search techniques. Extrasolar planets had not really been discovered back then. So could you talk a little bit about what drew you into the search for planets?
This was in the mid to late 80s. And like you say, extrasolar planets had not yet been discovered. But I had worked on a project where we had linked terrestrial telescopes into a network so that we could maintain continuous observations of these variable stars. And these are pulsating white dwarfs, so they pulsate in their atmospheres. And you can deduce things about the internal structure of the star and the equations of state from the observations. So we were doing these observations in the mid-80s, and we had one source that the pulsation patterns were shifting over time. And the only way we could explain that was that it was a precession from a planetary object around the star. So we were convinced that we were going to be the first to detect an extrasolar planet. And being a Star Trek nerd, I thought, oh my God, we're gonna detect a planet. So that got me very excited. It wound up after years of observation that we did not actually detect a planet. But by then it was too late. I was already hooked on planet detection as a goal. So when I graduated, I was offered a postdoc at NASA Ames working with Bill Borucki. And Dr. Borucki is the PI of the Kepler mission. So as you know, Kepler has discovered them. Hundreds, thousands of extrasolar planets. At that time, he was looking at the precision photometry that it takes to do planet transit detections. And that's what my thesis was about, was precision photometry. So I went out to Ames to work with him on making ultrasensitive detection techniques that ultimately wound up being the Kepler telescope.
Oh, cool. So you started at NASA as a scientist, but quickly moved over to the technology side and wound up managing the robotics lab. So how did that happen?
Well, that was an interesting path. Like I say, I was always interested in the implementation side. So as a scientist, what I was doing was developing new instruments. I was interested in how you make them more sensitive, how you make them more precise. And there was an opportunity to work on an imaging system that was intended for a planetary lander. And so I moved over to the technology side of the house to work on this imaging system for the planetary landers. And that in turn led to working on systems that were instruments designed to be hosted by planetary rovers and planetary landers. So I gradually followed the instrument design path into the technology side because what I was trying to do was implement science.
During your time with the robotics lab, you worked on performing field science investigations through remote mobile platforms in an attempt to approximate what a scientist actually does in the field. What was the primary challenge that you found associated with this enterprise?
Well, the primary challenge was to do field science, you need a human. That's the primary challenge. And humans are very good at what we do. It's very difficult to replicate with a remote system what a human can do. So when I took over the robotics lab, one of the things that I focused us on was doing remote geology on a planetary surface, and in particular, trying to replicate what a field geologist, terrestrial field geologist, can do by walking around and with a pair of binoculars and with a hand lens. That is really the type of geology that we need to do on other planets, and replicating that capability is very difficult. So what we did was a series of experiments where we would attempt to replicate that capability through various ways. So the very first set of experiments was to take a first-year grad student, strap some cameras onto that person, and have a walkie-talkie link back to a professor who was directing the grad student. So the professor was telling him, go over here, look at this, pick that rock up, look at it, bring that close to the camera so I can see it. So that was the first attempt. But a human, a first-year grad student, is incredibly capable, and so can walk around, can go anywhere you want. So a remote scientist can say, go over there, climb that cliff and grab that rock. Well, that's tough for a robotic system to do, even now, and this was back in the early 90s. So even now, it's tough for that type of thing. And so we gradually worked on systems that either relayed stereo imaging to a human through a remote link. We would build virtual environments with all of the information from the site that was collected and was being collected by the remote system. And we present that to the human in a way that let them, the human scientist, do what they would normally do, or our goal was for them to do what they would normally do in field geology. And we would test these in remote terrestrial locations that were representative or terrestrial analogs of the planetary locations, the moon, Mars, et cetera.
So doing remote science to planetary rovers seems pretty natural these days, but you say that was not always the case. So can you explain what it takes to change the thinking of the science community about ways to adapt technology to science?
Yes. So scientists are inherently suspicious of anything that gets between them and their measurement. So a classic case of this is compression. In the early days, even now, you're always limited by how much data you can transmit to the ground. And so you want to look at compression techniques to send more data over limited bandwidth to the ground. That's always been a challenge with the science community because they don't want any kind of lossy compression because that might wipe out the measurement that they're actually trying to use. So given that, scientists are inherently suspicious of anything that gets in the way. So back then, it was commonly accepted in the science community, in the planetary science community, that you could do everything you needed to do from fixed landers. So this is similar to what Viking did in the 70s. You land at a spot, you look at that spot, you can look at anything within range of your cameras, and you can grab anything within range of your robotic arm, but you don't need to move around. So the basic premise back then was we can do everything from fixed landers. If you need multiple locations, then you send more landers. You go wherever you need by sending landers to them. So I was part of a group at NASA at multiple field centers, at Ames, JSC, lots of field centers, JPL. And we were trying to demonstrate that mobility was possible. It was not only possible, but was actually enabling of the science. And so to convince the science community, what we wound up having to do was analog field testing, where we would go to the Antarctic, we would go to the Hawaiian volcanoes, we would go to the Mojave, we even went to Kamchatka. Kamchatka is a great analog to a remote planet. And we would try to do field geology through these systems. So we would build rovers, we would take them out to the sites, we would create satellite links back to a control center, we would have the science team at the control center trying to do remote geology and remote science through these instruments and these mobile systems. And we went even as far as to not tell the scientists where we were going, that they had to deduce everything about the geology from helicopter photos that we would use to simulate planetary descent imaging. We would have them achieve science goals not knowing where they were, with just the information that could be sent back from the remote systems. We would even program in delays. So when we went to the Kilauea volcano to do some of this work, we had two phases of the test. One phase was with a 3-second time delay to simulate doing it on the moon. Then another phase was a 30-minute time delay to simulate doing it on Mars. And we did a whole series over 5 years or so. We did a whole series of analog field tests, which basically convinced some early adopters in the science community that this was important. And that actually resulted in the current path we're on, where the Pathfinder rover was the first planetary rover on Mars, and now the two MERS, and now we've got Curiosity. That whole series of mobile platforms was actually a paradigm shift for the science community. They did not think they needed mobility until it was demonstrated the value of it.
About the same time that you're discussing, your team developed virtual reality techniques to present complex information to humans. And then you left NASA to apply that to other areas of application. How did that come about, and what kind of work did you do at the company that you and your colleagues started?
Well, Ken, the virtual reality techniques that we were using was an outshoot of the attempt to do remote science through a mobile system. We would build these virtual environments that were populated with data and information from the remote system and gradually build up a higher and higher fidelity representation of the remote site so that the science team could plan traverses and could plan science activities and preview the data and then basically access all the science data as if they were accessing an archive, but through this virtual environment. So that was a successful effort within NASA. And then myself and four other of my colleagues from NASA decided we wanted to spin off a company and try to commercialize this. So we left NASA and we licensed our own technology back from the government and then commercialized it. And we had several application areas ranging from true science applications for planetary exploration, but we were also looking at combining information streams for firefighting. We looked at visualizing corporate networks. So you could visualize, the technique allowed you to visualize any complex information. And so we had various application areas. And the one that seemed to be of the greatest interest to various customers was visualizing complex networks. So we would go in and to a corporate network, and we would sniff out the network, trace all the nodes, and then we would create a representation of that network that humans could use to diagnose problems or see attack vectors or things like that. So that was what we were attempting to do with this company. But given that we all had NASA roots, of course, we had to name the company in a symbolic way. So the company's name was Fourth Planet.
Yeah.
So before you left NASA in the mid to late 90s, you had advocated for a program that focused on artificial intelligence and data mining. So why are those research areas important for future NASA missions?
Well, those areas are important because we were rapidly running, and once again, this is the mid-90s, we were rapidly running into limitations at NASA where we were starting to run out of missions which were program the mission ahead of time, have it do a job like taking photos. So a lot of our planetary missions up until then were go to a new spot, take photos, take spectroscopy measurements, even take samples. But it was basically go somewhere and acquire data. And that's fine. That can be done with automated systems. It can be done with direct human-controlled systems, as long as you take into account the light travel time delay. But we were starting to get into limitations that required the systems to do more and more complex activities. And that required onboard capabilities that had not been developed yet. So this program that I was advocating for, and wasn't just me, there were a lot of folks at NASA who were advocating for this, but it was a program to develop local autonomy or local decision-making where a system could be goal-directed. You could tell the system, achieve this goal, and then the system, the local system, could decide how to achieve that goal and then what steps it needed to do and do all of that in sort of one command cycle. So you give it a goal, it does all that stuff, and then returns the data to you. Whereas the state of the art back then, and even now to some extent, was you tell it, you know, move 10 centimeters forward. You wait and see if it moved. Mm-hmm. Then move another 10 centimeters forward. and then extend your arm. So you're micromanaging the remote system. And so that's very inefficient, takes a lot of time. And NASA mission operations of remote systems typically costs $1 million a day. And so if you can do something in one command cycle rather than 10 command cycles, that's a great savings. So we were looking at local autonomy, automated systems that could work on the remote system. We were looking at human-centered computing, which is basically optimizing how humans and information systems work together, each of them doing what they do best. And then we were also looking at intelligent data understanding or data mining, which is quite popular these days. But it's dealing with these massive databases and understanding and discovering new information from them.
So you overlapped with Ken at NASA Ames in the late 90s. So can you talk a little bit about those days? Give us some good stories.
Well, I actually met Ken when I had left. I had already left NASA and was working in my company. And Ken had taken over as a director at NASA Ames. And one of the things that he was doing was looking around Silicon Valley to see how NASA could create synergy with Silicon Valley. And so we were a Silicon Valley company. We had roots back at NASA. So Ken's headman called up one day and said, "We want you to meet Ken Ford." You know, he wanted to interview you. And so Ken came out to our company, and that's when I first met him, was when he was doing this investigation. And then during that time, I had helped with the technical advocacy of a new NASA program. But while I was away, Ken was one of the key people that was convincing headquarters that this was an important program and advocating for it, and ultimately got it approved.
How did you become so interested in developing low-cost and yet relatively high-performance spacecraft designs? You know, this seemed to happen in a few years. Like, you seemed to go through a transition. Can you talk about that?
Yes, there was a dramatic transition in my thinking, because when I came back to NASA, I came back to help manage that intelligent systems program that Ken had advocated for. And we were working on that, and it was producing some really good results. And that was feeding into future missions like the MIR mission at that time. And so those results were quite promising. But I also got pulled into the, at that time, new vision for space exploration. This was when NASA pivoted to the moon, and we had the Constellation program. And during that program, one of the things I did was manage the Robotic Lunar Exploration program. And this was a program to create lunar precursor missions prior to significant human arrival and operations on the moon. So we had missions like Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which is actually still flying around the moon right now. We had the LCROSS mission, which detected ice at the poles of the moon. We were looking at lander rover missions as part of this portfolio. And one of the things that we rapidly ran into was NASA has finite resources, and a lander was horribly expensive. And not only that, but the rover that's carried onto the lander was horribly expensive. We were getting numbers in the $500 to $750 million range. And that was just killing the architecture, because NASA would have spent all of the money on these systems. And we myself and a couple of others, we knew there was a better way to do that. We knew technology was good enough where we could have landers and rovers that were a tenth the cost of these things. And so I got pulled into these studies through this program where we were investigating how can you do planetary exploration for very low cost and basically make it affordable. And so we looked at inverting the classic NASA pyramid. There's a standard NASA approach for doing science missions. You start with the science goal, and then you decide, what instruments do I need to achieve this science goal? And then you say, now with these instruments, what spacecraft do I design to host these instruments and do this mission? That's the standard NASA top-down approach. What we were investigating was the inversion of that. The standard approach works extremely well. You get great science results. There's no question about that. But you get into the death spiral that we were seeing at the time, where missions became more and more expensive. And because of that, you tend to stuff more and more things into the missions because you don't have a lot of opportunities to fly because they're so expensive. And then when you stuff more and more things into them, the missions become so important that you can't allow them to fail, which means you pay even more money to make them fail safe and make the reliability extremely high. And so this was a death spiral. As the missions grew in cost, you got fewer and fewer missions, and we were choking ourselves. So we were looking at a way to change that. And the way we investigated was, what if we invert the pyramid and we say, you start with what is your capability? What spacecraft or lander or rover do you already have? And then given that, what payload can you carry? So what science instruments can you carry that fit on that existing asset? And then once you know that, well, what science can you do from those instruments on that existing spacecraft? And so that's inverting the pyramid. It's kind of heresy. It runs into a lot of antagonism from from some in the community. But that was a way to do very low-cost missions. And the closest equivalent on the ground is, if you want to go pick up a bag of apples at the grocery store, you don't start by designing the car. You use what assets you have available, a car, motorcycle, a bicycle. You use an asset you have available. Imagine how expensive it would be to grab a bag of apples if you started with, I have to design the car, mm-hmm. and then I have to build the car, and then I have to drive the car. That's what we were trying to change.
STEM Talk is an educational service of the Florida Institute for Human and Machine Cognition, a not-for-profit research lab pioneering groundbreaking technologies aimed at leveraging and extending human cognition, perception, locomotion, and resilience.
So, Butler, in January of 2015, you joined IHMC as a senior research scientist, and then you returned to NASA on loan from IHMC via the IPA mechanism. Can you talk about that transition?
Yes. During the Intelligent Systems Program days, I got to meet and collaborate with a lot of IHMC researchers, and I was super impressed with the organization, and I thought, this is a great place. When the opportunity came to join IHMC, of course, I jumped at it. But a lot of my research and my work is done with, you know, flight missions at NASA. So I was assigned back to NASA from IHMC as kind of a loaned executive. It's the equivalent of a loaned executive program where I'm assigned back to NASA. I do NASA work from IHMC. So that's how I continued to work on the NASA effort while I was a senior researcher at IHMC.
You became the project manager for the Lunar Atmosphere and Dust Environment Explorer mission, otherwise known as LADEE. Was LADEE a result of your research focused on innovative and low-cost spacecraft designs, or how did LADEE come about?
It was a direct result. One of the things, I mentioned that we were inverting the pyramid. So one of the things that we looked at as part of that was what existing platforms are going to be available that you then use for different purposes. And I had an incredibly talented design team, and we initially looked at designing a family of lunar landers and then also separately a family of orbiters that could go anywhere in the cislunar environment. And this was supposed to be a building block. These two pieces were a building block, as I mentioned, to reduce the cost of lunar lander and orbiter missions. Well, this really talented design team, as we were investigating the spacecraft designs, we rapidly converged on modularity as important. So these were modular systems, and you design and build the module, and then you combine them in various ways. So obviously, the joke is that the Lego set spacecraft. But one innovation that the team came to, they had pursued parallel approaches to landers and orbiters. And they realized that once they broke them into their modules, that the modules were 80-90% overlap. So they created, we rapidly converged on what was called the modular common bus. And this was a spacecraft bus that was built out of modules, and you could configure it as a lander, you could configure it as an orbiter, you could configure it as a high power system, low power system. It can go anywhere in the on the lunar surface and can go anywhere in cislunar space. And that modular design, we had prototyped it. We actually had created a lunar lander variant of it. We built the full scale system and flew it around in a warehouse inside of a safety net to prove that it could do the job. It was stable. Well, at the time, the Associate Administrator for Science at NASA saw this demo, and this was Alan Stern, and he said, this is great. I want to look at the environment of the moon before we send a lot of astronauts, because the pristine environment around the moon will tell us a lot scientifically about how the moon was formed, what transport mechanisms are available. And one of the goals at that time was, are there lunar ices at the poles, the permanently dark shadows of the poles, that could be used as human resources? So he saw this design. He said, I want you to build me one of these, and I want to fly it low over the moon, and I want you to do this investigation of the lunar dust environment and the volatiles environment around the moon and research the transport mechanisms. So that spacecraft design effort, which resulted in the modular common bus, the first flight of that bus as a space mission was LADEE.
Do you see this concept of spacecraft modularity continuing into the future? Have people noticed this and taken note of it?
Yes and no. There is a lot of interest in modularity. You see, the Air Force, for instance, has had programs that were looking at modularity, where you could launch a system very rapidly from off-the-shelf parts that you put together quickly. NASA is less accepting of modularity. We do it in our architectures where, for instance, you'll find transport systems for a lunar base will be designed in a modular way so that they can serve different purposes. So you'll see them in major architectures like that. But we really haven't pursued much along the lines of spacecraft modularity. It's not because folks don't believe in modularity. They do. But the practical aspect is, once you attempt modularity, you pull it together, and then you rapidly get into the customization that happens. It's very hard to resist the customization. An example of that is LADEE was built out of a modular bus. Once you decide the launch vehicle you're going to go on, that establishes the mass limit that you have to throw at the moon. And then so you now have a set configuration. Well, we advertise that as we can carry two instruments, a total of 50 kilograms. So that was what the bus was capable of. And then in the inverting the pyramid paradigm, you say, all right, that's what I'm capable of. So now I have to decide what to put on there. Well, we had a science definition team that took those constraints and said, okay, you can take two instruments, so we want you to fly three. And then, oh, well, we also want you to fly a technology demonstrator. And so we wound up with four instruments. And it was possible to do, but we had to do more customization than pure modularity. So modularity is a great idea, great concept. People like to try it, but it often runs into the reality of missions typically need to be customized.
So you kind of discussed the overall goal of the LADEE mission, but what were the specific scientific objectives of the LADEE mission?
Well, we were primarily looking at the lunar environment. It's actually a lunar atmosphere or exosphere, but I always had trouble convincing people that the hard vacuum around the moon actually is an exosphere. But the terminology for it is a collisionless atmosphere, and solar system moons typically have them. And so one of the worries about ramping up human activity around the moon is it would disturb that pristine environment. So our goal was to characterize that environment both in terms of volatiles, atomic species, molecules. We were also looking at the dust environment. The dust is elevated around the moon whenever the shadow passes, so you have an interesting dust environment around the moon. You also have the moon's exosphere interacting with the solar wind. So you have a very complex system there, and the measurements are very delicate. So you have to make the measurements before you seriously disturb them in order for them to be valid scientifically, to help understand how the moon was formed and evolved, and in particular, the transport of materials around the moon. But one of the great resources that could be available on the moon are water, hydrogen in the form of water on the surface of the moon. And there are two areas of the moon, the permanently shadowed poles, where sunlight never reaches. So these are cold traps, and they can trap material. And one of the things that the LCROSS mission demonstrated was they detected water in some form. Now, you don't know what form it is. The joke is, it is a skating rink, or is it just hydrogen barely bound on the regolith? But they detected basically water in some form while impacting a crater to send up ejecta. And the form of that water could be a tremendous resource for future planetary bases on the moon. And not only that, as a refueling station for future human missions, because if you have water or hydrogen on the moon, then you can create rocket fuel that you don't have to lift out of the Earth's gravity well. So that was the motivation for it. And so the specific measurements that we made was to fly in and out of the Terminator very close to the lunar surface. And we were measuring both the dust in using an in-situ dust detector. But we were also measuring various molecules with a neutral mass spectrometer. And then we had a remote sensing instrument, which was a UV spectrometer, that we could look at both in absorption and emission for species right around the moon. And that was the scientific goal, was to characterize. We knew one or two species that were remotely sensed around the moon, but we didn't know everything that was there. So one of our goals was to characterize what was there. The other was we had Apollo measurements of glow from elevated dust. It was done as a famous sketch by one of the Apollo astronauts. And there were theories about what was causing that elevated dust. And we had some terrestrial experiments about how you could elevate dust with electric and magnetic field lines, but there was no in-situ measurement. So that was our other goal, was to look at the dust environment and characterize it along the column density or altitude above the lunar surface.
And LADEE was not only a science mission, but it also demonstrated several new technologies. Is that right?
That's right. I mentioned that we had the three science instruments. The fourth instrument that we were carrying with us was a laser communication system. And we were the first mission to carry into deep space an optical communication system. I mentioned that one of the things that drives the amount of science that you can bring back from deep space missions is your communications bandwidth. And up until today, and still today, we primarily depend on radio communications. So we have the Deep Space Network on Earth, which is a network of very large antenna. And then we have various S-band, X-band, Ka-band. We have these various radio systems on our remote spacecraft that send data back to the Earth. But the bandwidth of optical communication is so much higher than radio communication that if you can close a radio communication, an optical communication link, you can transmit orders of magnitude more data back. So one of the things we carried on LADEE was an optical communication system that was built by MIT Lincoln Labs. Mm. And this was the first attempt at closing an optical communication link from the moon back to the Earth. And the basic RF system that we use, radio system that we use to transmit our science data, was a factor of thousands less than what this optical system could do. And we could transmit our entire spacecraft in memory back over the optical system in just a few seconds. So it really proved out what optical communications can do. And now there's a couple of other missions that have come along. One is to look at optical cross-link spacecraft, and then there will be an optical comlink that will go on the Psyche mission that will close a very long distance optical comm link from a spacecraft that's visiting a metal asteroid.
So I have to say, I remember reading articles about LADEE crashing into the backside of the moon, which was intentional. can you tell us about the trajectory of the LADEE mission, from launch to crash, I guess?
Sure. It was actually a very interesting trajectory problem, and we had a very talented trajectory design team that put it all together. But we used a technique called phasing loops. Basically, to capture around the moon, you have to have very precise timing for when you do your burn, your main engine burn, to capture around the moon. So because the timing was so critical, there are a couple of ways to do it. One is the way the Apollo missions did it, where you have a direct trajectory, which has very precise timing. They also have lots of fuel. But our mission, because of the limitations of the launch vehicle and because of the volume limitations of our propulsion system on our spacecraft, we really couldn't afford to do it that with the very precise timing. So we used a different technique where you could launch and then we flew three phasing loops around the Earth. And what that did was the phasing loops gradually got us up to the lunar altitude, so we were near the moon, but we could do burns within these phasing loops to adjust the timing. So we could launch in a wide range of launch dates and times, and then we could adjust the timing as we flew through these phasing loops so that we arrived at the moon with the precise timing we needed to capture. And so we flew these three phasing loops, and then we were at lunar altitude when the moon swung by, whipped us around the back of it. So we got a gravity assist from the moon to whip us around the back of it. And then we did our critical main engine burn to capture around the lunar in lunar orbit. Then we checked out everything in high lunar orbit before we were starting to burn fuel, and then dropped down low over the moon to do our science experiment. And the moon has a very lumpy gravity field. So when you're flying close to it, you have to do a lot of maneuvering to keep yourself in the altitude band that you want for the science. So we checked out everything in a high lunar orbit and then dropped down into this very low lunar orbit, which is about 50 kilometers. And we were doing our science experiments at 50 kilometers. And then the science detection got better and better as you got lower and lower altitude. But because you didn't know exactly how far above the moon you were, the lower you got, the more chances you had running into mountains and other terrain. So we did the whole primary science experiment and then the extended science mission. Most of that was at 50 kilometers, but towards the end of our mission, headquarters gave us the approval to take extreme risks and drop lower and lower in order to get these science measurements that you can only do a few kilometers above the lunar surface. So we were skimming the lunar surface at orbital velocity, and this was intentionally, so we could get this low altitude science. And then right at the end, we were flying so low that we knew we were going to impact somewhere. And the NASA safety rules were that we could not impact anywhere near an Apollo site. Right. So it was a historic site. So we had to guarantee that we would not impact anywhere near an Apollo site. So the trajectory team designed the trajectory so that we were guaranteed to impact on the far side of the moon where there were no historical sites. But we didn't know exactly where it was going to impact because at that point we were skimming over these crater walls and mountains by bare meters. We wound up impacting, to my great satisfaction, we impacted on the far side of the moon, but it was on the side of the moon we could still hear. So, you know, you have a slight oscillation of the visibility of the far side of the moon, and right on the edge between the near side and the far side, you can actually still talk to your spacecraft. We wound up running into a crater wall that was still in view of the Earth. So we got data all the way to the impact and downloaded. The team went through heroic efforts to make sure that every piece of data on the spacecraft, science data on the spacecraft, was sent to the ground before impact.
Yeah, I actually recall some in the media harping about NASA bombing the moon.
Yeah. I've ever seen that too. It's like, no, that's not quite the case.
No, not quite.
Yeah, poor moon. Right now, you're the project manager for NASA's Arcus mission, which has just completed the initial design phase, a really important goal. What are the science goals of this mission, the goals of Arcus?
Well, Arcus is a high-resolution X-ray grading spectrometer mission, which means it's not an imaging mission. It's not taking pictures in the X-ray, but it's looking at spectra in the X-ray. It's an order of magnitude more sensitive than any other X-ray mission that's ever flown. So it's actually going to see things that no other mission can see. The primary science goals, we have three of them. One is how does matter cycle in and out of galaxies and clusters? This is the missing baryon, or also known as dark matter problem, where we think we have evidence that most of the dark matter, the missing matter in the universe, could be in these hot halos around galaxies and clusters. This is material that's heated up and expelled from the galaxies, and you can't see it in optical. So it's invisible in optical, but you can see it in X-ray. And the way that we plan to do that is look at background sources like quasars, and we see the hot material around galaxies and clusters. We see them absorb the light from the distant object, the quasar, and then we can tell from those absorption lines what the material is, how hot it is, how it's moving, and that lets us investigate the dark matter or the missing baryons. And then our second one is a basic question of what powers these supermassive black holes. We're looking at, and these are the materials that are ejected from the galaxies, from the central cores. With X-rays, we can see directly that material, and by looking at radial velocity shifts, we can tell how the material is moving, what type of material it is. And so this will help us understand the mechanism of powering these supermassive black holes and how we eject material from them. And then the third one, so we're dropping in scale. So one is galactic scale and clusters, galactic clusters, and then individual galaxies and supermassive black holes. And then we drop down to how do stars and protoplanetary disks form and evolve. And this is looking at individual stars and planetary disks. which are also visible in the X-ray because it's superheated material that emits in the X-ray.
It's really quite something when the bottom of your size scale are stars.
Yes. Yeah. That's the smallest.
That's thinking
on
big.
The micro scale.
What are the new technologies? You hinted at it, you know, very high resolution, but what are the new technologies that are really driving the possibility of the ARCUS mission?
Well, the ARCUS mission depends on two key technologies that are just now at the point where they can fly in space. One is silicon pore optics. These are X-ray optics that have never been flown yet, but they are planned for a future ESA, a European Space Agency mission. And so ESA has been developing these optics technologies for large area X-ray optics. So these are the things that focus the X-rays in the system. That's the first technology. The second technology is called CAT gratings. That's critical angle transmission gratings. These are the elements that disperse the light into the rainbow that you're used to seeing with optical light. Once you disperse the light, you can see the lines of heated material, which is what we're looking for. So the combination of these focusing optics, the SPOs, and then the X-ray gratings, the CAT gratings, that's really the new technology. ARCUS, unlike LADEE, the new technology is not the spacecraft. The spacecraft is a standard commercial spacecraft. It's actually the same spacecraft that is flying right now for the TESS mission, which is a planet finding mission. We're using the same spacecraft. So the innovation in ARCUS is all in the X-ray instrument.
So can you talk about the complexity of developing a robotic platform for space or lunar exploration? And specifically, what the makeup of your team at NASA Ames looks like for these missions?
So robotic science missions typically consist of a spacecraft or a rover if it's on the planetary surface, but a spacecraft. A rover is actually a spacecraft. It's the spacecraft, and then it's the instruments that are carried by the spacecraft, the science payload. It's called the science payload. And then the ground systems that support it. So the ground controllers and the communication systems that talk remotely. So those are the components of a typical science mission. Sometimes you have other systems like manipulators or drills that are added, but they're usually considered part of the science payload. Each of those elements, so the spacecraft as well as each instrument, typically consists of kind of a standard set of technologies. So you have the mechanism itself. You have the structure of it. You also have power. You have communications. You have software. Spacecraft, the joke now is that spacecraft are basically software flying in a structure. So each of those disciplines requires a specific type of engineer. So you'll have a power supply and electrical engineer that designs the power system or manages the power system. You'll have a software engineer that does the software. You'll have a communications engineer that does communications. So the team consists of specialists in each of these disciplines. And then you also have specialists in ground control, mission operations. Mission operations is basically a human type activity for how you control the system and the remote system and how you command it, how you get data back from it. That also requires specialists who are mission operators. So all of these specialists come together to create the architecture and the design. You go through multiple phases where you prove the design on paper, and then you iterate on the design, get it into a final form, do some terrestrial testing if needed on anything you're flying that's new, and then you commit to building it. And then obviously once you build it, you have to test it on the ground to make sure you have built something that can survive in space, which is non-trivial. And then you launch it and operate it. So you need a variety of scientists, mission operators, and engineering discipline experts that form the team that come together to do a robotic science mission.
So as you talked about at the beginning of the interview, you grew up as a classic nerd, as you said you still are. I'm not saying that you said that.
Yes.
Dreaming of becoming an astronaut. And you may not have become an astronaut, but you've certainly made an incredible career at NASA. So what advice do you have for young people today who are interested in a science career and perhaps one day working at NASA?
Well, my first piece of advice is get a technical degree. So no amount of education is wasted in working in space. So get as much education as you can that a lot of engineering can go through the undergraduate level, and then most of good engineers, most of their education is after they graduate. Scientists tend to go all the way to a PhD and then specialize in some kind of science discipline. But get a technical degree, engineering, science, math, any of those technical degrees. That's kind of the first goal. The second step is get yourself involved in NASA in some way. NASA sponsors lots of internship opportunities. Internships are a great way to get involved. On LADEE, it's primarily a passion of mine, was we had a lot of interns. And these are summer interns. We would have an army come in each summer. And then some of the students who were close enough geographically, they would work in the spring and fall as well. And those interns, when they graduated, several of them were hired by NASA. We had a very high transition rate from interns to on-site staff. And when my fellow project managers during LADEE, when we were in some of the critical phases of the mission, we would look in the operations center and we would say to ourselves, you know, everyone in there started as an intern just 4 years ago and then built the spacecraft and are now operating in the spacecraft. So connect to NASA in some way through internships. You can also connect to NASA through sponsored research, where you're working at your own institution under a professor or as a part of a research team working on NASA problems. That's a great way to get connected. Another path that's not through NASA, but get a job in aerospace. It's a very tight-knit community. Most folks in their career will run into each other over and over again in their mm-hmm. career. So working at an aerospace company that specializes in building spacecraft or building instruments for spacecraft or building components for spacecraft, that's also a great way to get involved. And these days, there's a path that was not available to me when I was growing up, which is commercial space. You have a lot of opportunities now with commercial space and entrepreneurial space where you can get involved in space without going through any kind of government route. These are through private companies that are doing space exploration themselves on their own resources.
So what do you see as the exciting next steps in robotic space exploration and science?
Well, I mentioned that we were rapidly running out of opportunities to just go and take a picture. And I don't want to make that sound easy. That's very hard.
Yeah.
But you go somewhere, you take a picture, and you go someplace for the first time, and you find out what's there. Once you get past that point, you get into the type of science investigations that require a lot more decision-making on board in order to do it, because the light travel time is so long, especially for very deep space missions like asteroids or Jupiter or beyond. You don't have the luxury of having a controller tell the spacecraft, do this, now do this, now do this, because you can have, you know, multi-hour light travel time in between. So yet we're transitioning into missions that require a lot of onboard decision making. And one of the things personally, what I think is exciting is we've started to plan missions that are going to go to active moons of either Jupiter or Saturn. And those missions are extremely interesting because we have places like Europa where there are conditions in the subsurface sea of Europa that could mimic the conditions on Earth where life arose around the vents. The hot vents at the bottom of the ocean is one place that life thrives on the Earth, and it's potentially a place where life started. Well, we know that Europa, it's covered by ice, but it has a large ocean below it. That ocean may be, because of the tidal stresses with the moon orbiting around Jupiter, may have hot vents, and those hot vents could be a location for life. So missions that we're starting to do or starting to plan, which will send a spacecraft to Jupiter, to Europa, investigate, land, and then ultimately we like to burrow under the ice and send a submersible exploring the oceans of a moon like Europa. If you think about how hard that problem is, where you have to send a spacecraft to Jupiter, you have to land in this incredibly harsh radiation environment in the Jovian system. It's an extremely hazardous radiation environment where the electronics die easily. You have to land on a very jagged surface. You have to melt your way through the ice, and then you have to send a submersible down and explore completely out of contact with the Earth. That's a tremendously difficult mission. And I think that's, but it's part of the search for life. So I think that's one of the really exciting things that we're going to be doing in the next couple of decades.
It's really exciting.
I remember presenting the sketch outline of that kind of mission at a university. And after my talk, I was literally besieged by idealistic young engineers and computer scientists that otherwise would be making incredible salaries from right. this particular university. Mm. And they were all like, oh, dude, I'll do that for free. Yeah. When not thinking about spacecraft and space missions, what occupies your time? Do you have any hobbies of note?
I have three primary hobbies that I spend time on. I'm a pilot, so I love flying. I particularly like flying, you know, small planes to remote locations. That's one of my favorite things to do. I've also been in martial arts my whole life and various disciplines, a broad range of disciplines. I enjoy doing that. Of course, I'm approaching 60 now, so martial arts hurts a lot more than it used to hurt. And then camping and hiking are one of my passions. I love doing that.
So, speaking of which, I understand that your wife thinks that you are a potential hermit because your favorite thing to do is to get away and disappear into the woods and not talk to anybody for a week. Is that true?
Yes, that's true. She thinks I'm a hermit in training because in the Myers-Briggs scale, I have a big eye on introverts. So the way I decompress is to go out in the woods where there's no cell phone coverage, disappear, not talk to anybody for a week. I love that, and I come back recharged from that. Mm-hmm. Extroverts tend not to be comfortable not talking to someone for a week.
We share that trait.
Yeah, I'm right there with you too as well. So, Butler, it's been fantastic having you on STEM Talk. Thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, it was great, Butler.
Yeah, thanks. I enjoyed it.
STEM Talk.
So I know that Arcus is in preliminary development phases, but I certainly hope that the mission gets approved for launch in 2023, which is actually just around the corner.
Yes, indeed. Time will fly by until 2023. I also hope the mission gets the green light. I've known Butler for a long time now, and he is an exceptional scientist and engineer. Going all the way back to the Pathfinder mission and before, he's been a leading voice in convincing the science community of the need to change its thinking about ways to adapt technology to science.
If you enjoyed this interview as much as we did, we invite you to visit the STEM Talk webpage where you can find the show notes for this and other episodes, stemtalk.us. This is Don Cornega signing off for now.
And this is Ken Ford saying goodbye until we meet again on STEM Talk.
Thank you for listening to STEM Talk. We want this podcast to be discovered by others. So please take a minute to go to iTunes to rate the podcast and perhaps even write a review. More information about this and other episodes can be found at our website, stemtalk.us. There, you can also find more information about the guests we interview.